I'm pleased to have in the studio with me now Ray Hartley. He's down from the lofty heights of his office upstairs as the editor at large of the TMG Group. Welcome, Ray. Thanks for stopping by.
Hi.
By way of background, Ray was 20 years or so ago, he was the political correspondent of the Sunday Times. He travelled extensively with Mandela and Mbeki. He founded the Times newspaper and he was the editor of the Sunday Times. He was also, though, an administrator at the constitutional negotiations which ended apartheid. So Ray has had intimate first-hand knowledge of the transition to democracy. And he's written an excellent book about it called Ragged Glory, The Rainbow Nation in Black and White, and that's published by Jonathan Ball. Ray, I love the book because it is so readable, and by that I don't mean it's light at all. It's just very fluent, it really is quite a page-turner. But first of all, I want to ask you about the title. I know it's the name of an album by Neil Young,
yeah. But
it made me think of a flag. Is it not something to do with the American flag?
Yes, you know, Old Glory, yeah, the American flag. And I actually had the South African flag in mind, you know, because I was up on a hillside in Pretoria writing a story about free Wi-Fi that's being provided to Mamelodi and Attridgeville. And these people who were operating this free Wi-Fi from this abandoned old building, converted into a high-tech thing, had this pile of stones and this plastic pipe and this South African flag. And it was fluttering in the breeze, but it was all torn at the edges. And to my mind, that was a sort of a symbol of South Africa, you know, making things happen, and a little bit frayed around the edges, but there's still something happening. There's still some glory to the country. So the Ragged Glory for me really encapsulated that idea that we've done a tremendous amount of things over the last 20 years. There's a lot of glory here. There's the end of apartheid and bringing together of 9 different administrations and the abolition of dozens and dozens of laws that were discriminatory. And kids have access to education. You might question the quality. But it's ragged. Mm. We're getting to a time with a lot of very powerful people who are starting to challenge this South African, the South African way, the constitution, the way that we've decided to go forward as a country.
Mm. Enormous amount of material you had to work with over the 20 years. How did you even begin to start boiling it down? How did you choose what to leave out, really?
Yeah, it was very difficult. You know, I think the discipline of journalism actually is very useful in this, you know, because you're used to writing to a prescribed length.
Mm.
And actually, initially, when I started out writing this, I had to discipline myself to write longer. You know, you don't have to leave that out. You can put that in.
You can expand a bit on this and explain
okay.
a bit of that. Yeah,
that's not a feature page piece that's got to run to 1,000 words. You know, run it longer. And so, yeah, but there was a tremendous amount of documentation and stuff that I had. And it's quite interesting looking at recent South African history. There's two distinct eras in terms of access to information. There's what I would call the pre-internet era, and then there's the internet era, starting around in South Africa, mid to late 90s. And a lot of these documents and stuff are simply not available pre-internet. But once you hit the late 1990s, it becomes a lot easier to research because so much is available. There's archives, everything's, you know, a lot of documents are digitized and put online.
And some definitive biographies of the major players.
Wow. I mean, really awesome collection of writing, actually, you know, including biographies. I mean, Mark Gavissa's absolutely epic Thabo Mbeki biography, which just stands head and shoulders above everything else. It's monumental. You know, inadequacy inducing sort of writing when you look at it. Okay, I'll still have a go myself. And then, you know, all of the Khalima Motlanthe, Sororo Maphosa's biography, there's all this stuff, you know, Jane Naidu, Kata Asmal, F.W. de Klerk, his biography, quite underrated, I think, as a thriller. You know, it's quite exciting. There's stuff in there that's very readable. So all this stuff is there, you know. It's I just wanted to stitch it together into one story.
Which I think you've done very skillfully, but I can't imagine it would have been easy. The, quite early on in the book, there's this fascinating image of the first day in office of our new government. I remember Jeff Hadebe telling a dinner a while ago about that first day in the union buildings and how they arrived, and he came to his office. The desk was bare. There was a single telephone on his desk. There was not a file. There was not a secretary. There was absolutely nothing. He had this bare office, and he sat down to become the Minister of Public Works. And that's how it was, wasn't it?
It was, and even for Nelson Mandela. And, you know, in some cases you had this recalcitrant, reluctant bureaucracy sitting there, not wanting to be there, but having no choice. And you know, that the tougher ministers, the stronger ministers pulled it off. And the others started wading through very difficult dynamics. I mean, Trevor Manuel, when he took office, basically, you know, he had a few harsh words with a few people and brought his own team in and got going. You know, he didn't try to negotiate his way gently through the existing bureaucrats. And he retained a lot of very talented technical people. And he got rid of people that were not useful. So, for Mandela, I mean, it was, you know, incredible that he arrived there and it was empty. And there was, again, this recalcitrant, reluctant bureaucracy. But of course, being Mandela, it took him a day to work them over to his side. And now people like Zelda Lakranji write very glowingly about Mandela and the Mandela period, because he was able to absorb them.
It's just such an astounding thing. You think, how do you start governing a country from scratch? Do you think that Mandela's dream, or the dream of the Rainbow Nation, was always going to be unsustainable and implementable?
I think that part of the, I mean, many of the failings of today are inevitable. You know, is it possible for a developing country to implement this very vast and ambitious social project, to take resources that were directed at a tiny portion of the population and redirect them to everyone, to actually, you know, give everyone education and have a high standard of education. And I think that's quite a difficult thing to sift out what was inevitably going to happen when you took office. You were going to lose some of that momentum. There simply were not going to be the resources around to do what you wanted to do. So you got to separate that from the mistakes that were made, that things that could have been done better, and those mistakes, you know, we need to own those mistakes and actually say things went wrong, these things could have been done in a better way.
They seem to go wrong quite quickly. I mean, what happened to the much vaunted RDP?
Yeah, the RDP, you know, I think that if there was a gap in the preparation for the transition from the ANC side, it was its failure to develop a very sophisticated model for taking the economy forward. And in fact, there were many efforts made by groups like Merge and in the trade union movement. And as 94 approached, I think there was a bit of panic about, well, we need to get something on board. And the unions actually developed the RDP program. And the ANC sort of took that and ran with it, because it recognized that it had a ring to it, which would be very, you know, reconstruction and development.
And it was a working model. I mean, it was a real model.
It was there. It had been developed. There were some very good economists on the union side who worked very hard on this. But the truth was that it did not gel with the kind of approach that Mbeki and others had in mind for the way South Africa should go forward economically. And at a certain point, it became apparent that it was not possible really to simply operate on this reconstruction platform. You had to attract foreign investment. The money was not there to just redirect towards all of these projects. We had to get capital inflows into the country. And so the shift in direction with GEAR took place. really an attempt by Mbeki to say to the global investment community, we're open for business. You can trust us. We've got a sound macroeconomic framework. You know, come and spend your money here.
Mm, and then put Jed Naidu, his head role, didn't it?
Yes, and it was an extraordinary scene there, which I'll try to capture in the book, where, you know, he was called into the office and basically told, this is it. And he was, what? Yeah, this is it. You know, the RDP's over. As a ministry, of course, the RDP will continue. It will be part of the lifeblood of everything, and it's not going to be a specific, but in fact, it was over.
It was over.
So there was a different approach coming to bear from that point on. And, it was quite politically savvy, really, of them to then say, but we would love you to be the Posts and Telecommunications Minister. And I think at that point, Jay Naidu made the decision to stay inside the tent. And so, he then sort of disappeared into the background, really.
You see, what I like about your book, Ray, is this behind the scenes, the scenery that you give us. We know the broad strokes of history, but you give us this lovely behind the scenes stuff, like, for example, the Constitution. Now, we've become so used to our admired Constitution, and we forget how difficult it was to actually get that onto the table. Now, you mentioned that some people had to give up things that they wanted in the Constitution. Yeah. What is missing?
I think that there was a lack of clear definition about exactly what the hierarchy of rights would be, which has allowed interpretations to come to the fore, which have made things like freedom of expression secondary to other rights, putting it very broad strokes here. But it would have been nice if that had been clarified and simplified. Section 16 of the Constitution is still a very powerful free expression clause, but the suggestion in the Constitution is that it's subordinate to other considerations, that sort of thing. I don't think there's much missing from the Constitution. I think in the end we got a pretty good one.
I was quite surprised. It seemed to me how close we came to retaining the death penalty.
Yeah, these were, you've got to bear in mind that was a decision taken against public opinion. If you'd had a poll of everyone in South Africa, you probably would have had the death penalty because crime was beginning to become a real problem in the early 90s already. That was a touch-and-go thing, but the decision was taken that it's not consistent with the framework that we're adopting. And, of course, the ANC was very opposed to it because they had had many people executed. The Solomon Mahlangus and so on. So that's, and that stood and still stands.
Well, our Constitution. Ray, let's talk about corruption because that is so much part of our reality now. How are the seeds of it sown?
Well, this, I think, is something that was in our control, that we could have done differently. I think there were two very big mistakes that were made by Mandela, during the Mandela presidency. Of course, Mbeki played a large role in the decision-making there as well. But Mandela was the president, and, he should really take the responsibility. The first was not to deal with Sarafina II, the first major corruption scandal which erupted.
I'd forgotten about Sarafina until I read the book.
Sarafina was a shocker, really. I mean, they spent 14 million rand on a play to raise AIDS awareness. The second highest bid was 800,000 rand. They did it without following any of the tender procedures. It was just a ministerial order, do it, and it happened. And there's no suggestion that the minister then, Nkosazana Zuma, as she was then, that she took any money or stole anything. But the fact was that there was a complete and flagrant disregard for procedure, and an inflated tender was allowed to win. The second tender, by the way, is from the Windy Brow Theatre, who are people very competent and capable of doing this exactly this sort of production. It wasn't a hopeless bid. So instead of allowing Parliament to hold the minister to account and then taking action, she was essentially protected. I think at some point she made her way from Parliament to the Mandela's office and said, I can't take this anymore. There was a very feisty MP in Parliament called Manto Shabalala Msimang, who was chair of the health committee and was hauling her over the coals. So she was protected. Manto got promoted onto an executive position. The committee kind of wound down and some guy called Badenhorst got fired. But the minister got off completely, you know, without any consequences, and was then in fact promoted and became the foreign affairs minister. So right then and there, Mandela could have sent a very strong signal. No, we are not going to govern like this. Sorry, go back to Parliament. We have an accountability process. Face the music. And in fact, he could have even gone further and said, I encourage Parliament to do its duty, and I'm not going to protect members of the executive when they put a foot wrong. So that opportunity was lost. And then I think...
But why, Ray? Why didn't he?
Well, because I'm not sure. I don't think he was thinking long term. I want to undermine the, you know, moral fiber of society. So this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I think it's a spur of the moment thing. It was the first case. Suddenly, the government was faced with this, a senior minister, heavily criticized. What are we going to do? And the reaction was a bit knee jerk. I think it was. And also because the ANC is such a fractious party and always has been, holding it together is always a big issue. So the impulse to protect one's people is quite strong and continues to this day. So that was the first one. The second one, I think, was Busak. You know, Busak stole money out of the, essentially out of the church plates of Danish churchgoers who made donations to the anti-apartheid movement. Couldn't really be a worse thing to do. When I say stole, I mean fraudulently, etc. Just to be technically correct. So, again, Mandela sent his justice minister, Dalai Omar, to the airport with a crowd of people to welcome Busak to the country when he came to face trial. I mean, the signal sending your justice minister. It would have been bad enough if it was just a party hack who'd been sent. But to actually say the man in charge of administering justice in South Africa carries this man on his shoulders. And Dalai Omar gave a big welcoming speech. The crowd cheered. They carried Busak on their shoulders. And the signal was sent.
As a hero.
Yeah. That no matter how heinous your crime is, and this was not, you know, a crime that you could defend in any way, shape or form. It actually was robbery from the anti-apartheid struggle, you would be protected. And I think the politicians all got the message and corruption started becoming
so
larger
that
and larger.
culture of protectionism, and that's still absolutely entrenched now.
Yeah, I think we would have still had corruption. I think it's inevitable in a developing country undergoing transition. I think that, but the extent of it, a lot could have been done to turn the tide early on.
Mm. Can we talk about Julius Malema? We must talk about Julius.
Of course.
Another sort of mountain on the landscape here. You were speaking at Park Words last week, and you made the point that he's not going to take away from the parties that are here now, but in fact he's creating an entire new group of voters, people who haven't voted before.
Yeah, I think that it's a very underanalyzed thing because everyone looks at Julius and says, well, he's not going to take that many any votes from the DA, and he's only going to take a few from the ANC because they've all gone over already. So, you know, he's going to peter out. But if you look at the last 20 years, the first striking statistic for me is that almost the same number of people voted in 1994 as did in 2014. Okay, so then, despite the huge growth in the population over that period, now to over 50 million and then in the 30s. So what's happening here? What's happening, I think, is growth in apathy, in people's disillusioned and out of politics. So there were 34 million adults over 18 who could have voted in 2014. 25 million of them registered and 18 million of them voted. So that tells you something, that there's 16 million people outside of the electoral process because they don't see themselves being represented there. And Malema could mobilize a lot of those people. It's an extremely difficult task to do in politics, to get people out of apathy and into your political party and to register and participate.
And as you point out, it costs money to register.
It
so
does.
For a lot of people, it's actually not really affordable.
Yeah. And but Malema has resources, and I think he could become quite an effective mobilizer of a portion of those people. So I think he's got growth potential. You know, but he's got to get through his own trial, of course.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think he will?
I don't know. You know, it's been rescheduled for September next year. And then I suspect it may be rescheduled again until a little bit closer to the local government elections. But, you know, he's very positive and blustering about it. And one of the things that's happened is that because of the parlous state of the National Prosecuting Authority, the credibility of these prosecutions is now called into question. And Malema is able to play the politics card. I'm being hounded. Look at this NPA, the history and the way that they acted for Mbeki and then acted for Zuma. And so there could be quite a big political fallout if he's found guilty. But I think that's it's quite a strong possibility. You know, the money's there. The money trail has been followed. And it's clear that these tenders were there. They took place and that he bought certain farms and things through trusts. So, but will the prosecuting authority be capable of managing a huge trial like that effectively? That's the million-dollar question.
I think the thing about Malema as well is he is a man who understands symbols and understands symbolism.
Absolutely.
As, well, you know, in history others have. I don't have to say Hitler, obviously. And I think it's brilliant, the red overalls, that kind of thing. He understands the power of that.
He does. And he gets it's more than that. He actually gets the new media age. So he understands that if you dominate Twitter today, you will dominate the newspapers tomorrow. You know, and so he's all about the sound bites and the moments and the hashtag moments. He can generate them like no other politician can. And so all those symbolic things, pay back the money, chanting in Parliament, refusing to leave, walking out, you know, they have this huge potent value in this modern age because they fit that 140 character mindset perfectly. Mm-hmm. I don't think Julius has got much beyond 140 characters really to say, so it works for him, but he uses those characters very effectively.
He uses the theatre of it. Can you briefly, if it's possible, to briefly explain the struggles within the ANC?
Yeah, you know, there are different strands within the ANC. You had the exiles who came back and you had the internal mass democratic movement, which consisted of the trade unions and the UDF components. So there are these strands that have been there and that have never quite been at ease with each other. And, you know, South Africa's been ruled by a president who came out of prison and two presidents who came from exile. It's never been ruled by any of the internal democratic movement people, which is what makes Cyril Ramaphosa so intriguing as a potential candidate, because he would represent quite a big culture shift within the ANC to a different section of that party. And I mean, I think that it started out like that, but now it's become much more complicated. I think it's about patronage and support. Zuma wants people to have his back, and he rewards them with promotions, and we have very low grade, with some exceptions, low-grade cabinet, really. I mean, it's, you know, Tito Mboweni wanted to be in cabinet. Not good enough, apparently. You know, very successful governor of the Reserve Bank, highly intelligent, smart person.
You know, there's no space, you'd think.
No space for him in cabinet. Trevor Manuel's wandered off because I think he sees the National Development Plan is just falling to pieces, it's not being implemented. And, you know, it's just questionable as to why would you make those sorts of decisions. And the only answer can be, I want people around me that I can control and trust. And so government turns inwards towards the ANC and its politics and doesn't face outwards at the people that it's supposed to serve. and decision making becomes opaque because it's all to do with this internal politics. We've signed a memorandum with Russia, but you can't see it, people of South Africa. That's for us. We know what's going on in there. You know, so that's the dangerous thing that's happened there. The question for the ANC going forward is there anybody who can stand up and unify the party, you know, amidst all of these fractures? And that's a difficult one for them.
Absolutely. Ray, I've noticed the question of race is so much in the forefront again, and it's being aired on social media a lot and opinion columns a lot, blackface, the blackface stories. Do you think we can ever resolve this?
No, I mean, I think we come out of apartheid, so it's almost core to the to everybody's understanding of South Africa or belief about South Africa and the way in which they look at the country. I happen to think that it's not really a useful prism to understand modern South Africa because power has shifted substantially, and it's much more interesting to follow those who have power. And in some cases in business they're white, and in others in politics largely they're black. And in the civil service, you know, so if you look at it that way, there's a lot of contestation that's taking place, and I'm not sure all of it's to do with race. But having said that, I think it's a very handy thing for people to haul out when they want to diminish or bash a political threat. So, you know, the Teagle thing that was used with Lindy Mazibuko and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really spend too much time on that subject. There are a lot of people who are better qualified to analyze that than me, because I've never really followed it as an issue in post-apartheid South Africa.
It's more a social than a political issue. I think.
Absolutely.
I loved your recent comments about South African politics should go on the Tim Noakes diet. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I made a little bit of a sort of blunder there, because it's actually the Atkins diet that South African politics should go on, because too many carbohydrates, you know, then you're very excited, it's the World Cup and everyone's on a sugar rush, and then comes the depression afterwards, as you know, I think a month after the World Cup, the Protection of Information Bill was released, you know, for scrutiny. And so we're on this kind of high sugar rush, and maybe we need some substance, we need some protein, we need some
consistent. Yeah.
Somebody pointed out to me that actually the Tim Noakes diet is about fat more than protein. So to say that we need more fat, I think, is not appropriate.
There's a lot of fat on the gravy train.
Yeah.
I think so. Ray, is it fair to ask you for your visions of high roads and low roads ahead?
I think fundamentally we have a structure in place in the society that is being tested, but it hasn't failed the test. And that is that we have a democratic structure. Growing political competition is taking place. The possibility of the ruling party losing major metros like Joburg and Port Elizabeth and so on is there in 2016. They're very much alert to that. So that political contest, I think, is the thing that really is what would save this country from descending in the direction of a failed state, because you have a possibility of a change of power for the first time, I think, in some of these big areas. And the response of the ruling party will be to more effectively deliver, which is also a good thing. So they've taken Pravin Gordhan and they've put him in charge of local government. So for the first time, the local government minister isn't that other guy that we also need to get into the cabinet. What can we give him? It's actually, I'm taking a top person and putting him there. So he's cracking the whip to try and get local government delivery going, because they understand that there's a political threat. Mm-hmm. So that's how this system is supposed to work. Whether or not it can win the race against those who want to start dismantling it by challenging aspects of the Constitution and by maybe eventually trying to affect the outcome of elections possibly, which is what happens in many cases in these sorts of situations, is a moot point. You know, I'm still positive. I think that this society is too strong to allow that to happen, and that there is a bedrock out there of belief in the constitutional values that will not be shaken.
Yeah, and you quote Edwin Cameron on that.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the book.
Yes, I think that, you know, he was quite clear that we're not becoming a failed state. We have these very powerful institutions. I do think there is an asterisk that's got to be put at the end of that, which is you can have this fantastic judiciary, one of the best in the world, but what if the cases never come to court? Or what if when they do come to court, you have incompetent prosecutors or prosecutors not really that keen on pursuing it because they see it as career limiting? Because the way the prosecution service has been reshaped now is it's become a site of patronage almost. So that is the fear, you know, that we would have these great institutions, fantastic constitution, a great judiciary, but without the NPA and the police, can you actually stop the rot?
No, that's a very, very sobering thought. Do you think as a nation we're in need of new heroes? And if so, where will they come from?
Wow, I think absolutely. I think it's a bit of a problem about South Africa that we look up to the top and what we see there affects us so violently. There are many other societies that would tut-tut and you know, not allow Zuma to give them sleepless nights. But that's how we are. It's a very patriarchal almost model, you know. It was done by the apartheid presidents. They were the, you know, P.W. Botha was the sort of, you know, ultimate grand duke in charge. So it would help if we got somebody up there who was at least vaguely respectable, because then you could, the nation, I think, would move forward. They would just, it would release a lot of positive spirit. And where these heroes are going to come from? Well, I think the opposition is producing some interesting people. Unfortunately, one of them has gone off to Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I think within the ANC, there's some interesting people. You know, there is Ramaphosa, whose reputation has been dented, but he's a very charismatic, powerful person. And I saw him in action at the Constitution, so I believe in Ramaphosa's adherence to and value in, you know, that he values the Constitution. I saw him fighting for it.
And the old ideals of the party.
Yeah. So, but he has these things hanging over him. You know, it was very, he made some mistakes with Marikana. You know, I don't think he sent the troops in to shoot people. But he was involved in that, getting on the board and, you know, being one of those types of distant people, instead of saying, right, I'm going to use this opportunity to try and do something about the workplace at Lonmin.
Mm. Do you regret having to end the book in terms of, because the story's changing all the time? I was thinking about what's coming out now about the arms deal, you know, the Eiffel Tower. What do you think of
yes.
that?
Yeah, no, I think it's inevitable. You know, South Africa is going to generate these sorts of things for a long time. So at some point you've got to stop, you know. And the 20 years seem to be the right point to do that. But I do think, I mean, I think that a lot has happened even since April when we were 20 years old. So it's phenomenal, you know, what has taken place. So might have to write a chapter or two in the not too distant future.
In the next edition.
Yeah.
In the updated edition. I love, scattered throughout the book, are the most lovely anecdotes. There's one about Madiba's dinner with Grasser
yes.
in Paris.
Yeah, it was wonderful. You know, he was in Paris and he had a big collection of journalists with him. There was a very open presidency. You know, it was amazing. You traveled and he took every opportunity to come and say hello, and his spokesman dined with you, not with him, understanding that that was the job, to communicate. And so he had this trip to Paris, and he was very happy. He was such a charming, made all these wonderful speeches about Paris and the trees and the Champs-Élysées. And behind the scenes, he was visiting Grace and Michelle, who was staying at, quietly been flown in and was staying at Barbara Masekela's house. And I got onto this and luckily preserved it for Sunday. We had a big splash in the Sunday Times, Mandela's Paris Romance. But it was an extraordinary moment, really, you know, where he, you know, he was such a mensch, you know, he wore his heart on his sleeve, really, you know, he couldn't conceal his happiness. And it was wonderful because it actually told you again that this was such a genuine and wonderful relationship that they had. It came from the heart. They were like teenagers, you know, sneaking off at night quietly and having dinner with their close friends and so on. So that was a wonderful story to write against the background of all this heavy politics.
And you thought they were going to come down heavily on you for writing the story, whereas in fact they didn't.
Yes. In fact, afterwards I felt that slightly used feeling that you get when you're a journalist from time to time. That maybe, you know, the whole thing had been leaked and that this was a way of telling South Africa about what was going on.
Sure.
Which, you know, in retrospect, I have no problem
having done that. You sold us a lot of newspapers that Sunday.
Absolutely. That was a flyer, yeah.
Ray, I think this book lends more to our understanding of ourselves as a nation than many others on the shelf at the moment. So I say well done. What's next for you apart from an updated version?
Well, I've got a major website that we're launching soon called rdm.co.za, which is Rand Daily Mail. And we've taken this very venerable newspaper brand and rebooted it for the Times.
I think it's brilliant. I've seen those archives downstairs of all that material.
There's
fantastic.
Wonderful material, and there's an incredible collection of writers in the group that are going to, whose work is going to feature on the site.
I look forward to that. Thank you, Ray. That's Ray Hartley on his book Ragged Glory, The Rainbow Nation in Black and White, and that's published by Jonathan Ball.